This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The Death of Vishnu is a new novel from Manil Suri. In fact, it is his first, and it is very good. It is dark, sweet, and comic. At the center of The Death of Vishnu are the residents of an apartment building in Bombay. One of the residents is Vishnu. He lives and is dying on one of the landings in the building. Manil Suri grew up in an apartment building in Bombay. The building that was home to his family was also home to a man who lived and died on the landing outside their apartment. His name was also Vishnu, and he inspired Manil Suri to create the central character of The Death of Vishnu. Manil Suri, in addition to being a writer, is also a mathematician. He earned his Ph.D. in mathematics from Carnegie Mellon University. He teaches at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Listeners, you're invited to join our conversation this afternoon. Questions and comments are encouraged. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Manil Suri's novel, The Death of Vishnu, is published by W.W. Norton. Manil Suri, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Good. The Vishnu that was the inspiration for the Vishnu of your novel, what was he like?
Well, I used to see him as I was growing up. He would always be on the steps. He was often drunk. He would always wave to me, say salam. He would always be smiling. And he performed errands for our family. You couldn't pay him too much because he would just use it all up and drink.
Hmm. And that was some time ago. How long ago was that?
I can't remember exactly, but I know that he was around when I was in school and when I was in college. So that must have been at least 20, 25 years ago, more than that.
At that time, did you find yourself imagining his life, what it had been like before he came to live on the landing?
No, I didn't. I would just go by, and there would be other people on other landings as well, and people on the street below, and you just didn't think about that.
Yeah. And then how was it that this memory recurred to you and became the inspiration for the character that's in the novel?
Well, what happened was I went back in 1994, and Vishnu was very sick. He was on his landing, and he was sick, and then he died while I was visiting my parents. And I started writing about it about a year later, and the first thing that occurred to me was, all these people, including myself, had not really done anything to save him. Not that we could have, perhaps, but I started writing about it. And initially, I thought this is very sad and we should all be guilty. But then some other things started emerging when I looked at the equation between him and the residents of the building. It wasn't so cut and dry anymore.
Hmm. The equation between...
Yeah, the equation. I had to sneak that word in.
Yeah. That's very interesting that you say that. Because as, realizing that you are a mathematician, one of the things that I thought about as I was reading the novel was that these folks in the building, all of them, their lives run parallel to one another, yet they all intersect.
Oh, that's too frightening for a mathematician to contemplate. That can happen in non-Euclidean geometry, but we won't get into that.
That's good, because I couldn't talk about that at all. I couldn't even ask you a question about it. But anyway, let's talk about the people in the building and how they all come together yet remain so distant from one another.
Yeah, the people on the first floor in the building are the Asranis and the Pathaks, and they share a common kitchen. And this is one of the sources of humor in the novel. It was also one of the sources of, I would say, a lot of trouble and fighting and agony in my childhood, because my family actually did share a kitchen with the next-door neighbors. And then as you go up the building, people include the Jalals, who are a Muslim family who live on the next floor up, and they're the only Muslim family in this building, which is all Hindu. And this reflects the composition in India, where the Muslims are a minority. And then finally, on the top floor, there is a widower. His name is Vinod Taneja. He's lost his wife many years ago, and he has become quite distant from the rest of the world. And there are also a few other denizens who live on various landings or who work in the building and who are on the ground floor. They're the shopkeepers and so on.
Mm. Is it common to have folks living on landings in apartment buildings in India and Bombay?
Especially in Bombay, I think. It's not so common in other cities, from what I understand. But in Bombay, space is at such a premium that any scrap of space that someone can carve out for themselves would be really prized. Because if you have something like what Vishnu has, you would already be one step above people who would not even have that, who would be really out on the street, especially in the monsoon, for instance.
Mm. It makes one think about what it is to have a good life.
It does, in a way. But the interesting thing is that he had a better life than some other people. So it's always a hierarchy, and that perhaps is much more apparent in India compared to here.
Mm. And these two families that are living at the same level, the Asranis and the Pathaks, there's conflict going on between here at this level without hierarchy, isn't there?
That's right. In some sense, even though I didn't discuss this much in the book, they also represent two different communities. The Pathaks are Maharashtrian and the Asranis are Sindhi. And there's a lot of conflict between different communities which have different cultures in India. And so in some sense, these two symbolize that conflict as well.
Mm. Give us a sense of these two women, Aruna and Usha. What do you think of them?
Well, I think that they're both quite lovable in their own nasty way. Certainly, I was affected by fights that perhaps my mother had with our next door neighbor. But they found themselves in this apartment, and they have. I mean, the thing is that if there are limited resources, then you really have to fight for them. And so they fight over the common tank that feeds them water. They fight over the kitchen space that they're allotted. They steal each other's ghee, and they do these minor petty things. I remember when I was growing up, the water tank was always a problem. It would run out by noontime, and then there would be not enough water for a bath, and there would be accusations flying that so-and-so took two baths instead of one. And so that's the kind of thing that I was trying to express.
Yeah, and today that's funny, but then I imagine it wasn't so funny when you're living in the midst of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And these two women, they're Hindi, and their upstairs neighbor, the neighbors, the Jalals, are Muslim. And so about the only thing Aruna and Usha can come together on is that they see the Jalals as other.
Yes. I mean, if you notice in the book, they're squabbling initially, but then when Mrs. Jalal enters the picture, they sort of unite and form a united front against her.
Mm. And Mrs. Jalal, she has Vishnu's interests at heart, I think, although I don't know what it would be like, you know, what would be better for Vishnu for him to remain on his landing or to go away to this charity to be taken care of by Muslims.
Well, I think Mrs. Jalal certainly does come up with a reasonable proposition, and that is rejected basically on the basis of religion more than anything else. I would suspect that that would have been in Vishnu's best interests. But Mrs. Jalal has other things to worry about. Her husband, Mr. Jalal, is someone who's very secular in his outlook. He's a man of science, of rational thought, of logic, and he has turned his back on his religion, and he's sort of casting a net around, trying to find if there is something beyond his own limited sphere of thought, of logical thinking. He's grasping for something spiritual, but he doesn't quite know what that is.
Yeah.
And this makes Mrs. Jalal quite upset.
Right. He's suffering a crisis of intellectualism.
I think so. He doesn't quite know what he wants, and that makes the search even harder.
Yeah. You know, we often hear someone talk about a crisis in their religious faith. I wonder if it's just as likely that a person of science can suffer a crisis of intellectualism.
I think it is. Certainly when I was researching this book, I didn't exactly suffer a crisis, but writing about such spiritual topics certainly made me question things that I hadn't questioned before, and think along lines that perhaps a mathematician would not be used to thinking.
Hmm.
And Mr. Jalal was very convenient for me because I was able to put all these questions into his mouth, and he was almost an alter ego in some ways.
Huh. And so how has this character in turn affected you and your mathematics?
Well, I don't know if he's affected my mathematics, except perhaps producing less of it because I've been writing. But I think what has happened is one of the texts that I really studied to prepare for this book was the Bhagavad Gita, since that has, that is a discourse between Krishna and Arjuna, and Krishna is supposed to be an incarnation of Vishnu. But I was very affected by just the common sense primer for life type of qualities that are embodied in that text. And I just find myself trying to live up to some of the ideals that are inside there. Things like trying to overcome one's ego or trying to do things without worrying about what the outcome will be, what kind of fruits you will get out of it.
Hmm. It sounds like it's a good thing to read at the moment for you, or to have at the moment for you, because this is, you know, such a wonderful novel, and it's getting some very nice attention.
And it's good to read that every night so that my head doesn't swell up.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon with writer and mathematician Manuel Suri. He's the author of The Death of Vishnu. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I just came back from a trip to India, and it was a wonderful experience. It was a very sad trip for me, but despite the fact that you see so many documentaries, movies, and you know hear about them, but unless and until you see this, it's very, very hard to imagine. I came back really very disappointed about human beings, that how can we live and not do anything about the people, that so many people are suffering so much, children and poor people and all that. And I was wondering if the gentleman could lead me to a book and help me to see what is exactly going on in India as far as the class structure goes. I was talking to some of the people that I visited, and my question was, how could this be? And those people, it seemed that they were, you know, very well-to-do kind of a people. They were saying, oh, don't worry, these people are happy, and this is the way they are accepted, and it is based on their Hinduism belief. And they went on telling me that apparently in Hinduism, you are born in your caste, and you live in that caste, and you die in that caste. And you, if you try to get out of it, it's considered a sin. So I just don't know if it is true or not. I'm not challenging it. I just want to see, is that true or not? And is there a book that you can let me know I can read about this? For example, she was telling me about this young man who kind of ran out of the village and went on and went somehow and studied and all that. And she was saying that, no, he has a miserable life because he's not accepted in his own village. And she was somehow very coolly and very relaxed kind of attitude was saying that we would never accept him because he's not within our caste. And I just could not believe. I said, my God, this is completely opposite than, you know, the world that I'm, you know, I know that people are always encouraged, always help, and they're always looked at with such a great respect for the people that they work so hard and they make their life better.
Maybe I should respond to that.
Please.
Certainly the caste system was, it's an ancient system that started as a way of differentiating people in terms of the work they did. So it was a sort of method of dividing society into different professions. And over the years, it did evolve into something more rigid. There are villages where it's still very rigid, and it certainly has a lot of negative qualities associated with it, as were brought out by this person. But on the other hand, there have been changes as well. I think this was one of the big things that Mahatma Gandhi started, where he embraced the people of the lowest caste. And changes are being made in the cities, for instance. I'm from Bombay, and I have to tell you that in the 20 years that I lived there, no one ever asked me what my caste was. And I should also point out that India is not just fully Hindu, that everyone would have a caste. There are many other religions there as well. So while I agree with everything that was observed, I personally haven't had experience of the caste system. And that's why in this book, I really concentrated on class, which can be just as insidious in many ways. The class system that makes Vishnu at the bottom of the heap really works on the basis of what you do, what kind of family you're from. It's not as rigid as the caste system because you can get out of it by, if you win the lottery, for instance. In terms of books, I think one book that would be quite interesting for this person would be A Fine Balance by Rohinton Mistry. It's a very good description of some of the things that happen in terms of caste.
So is it true, this notion of, you know, I know it's ancient, but if it is practiced or not, well, that is something that I need to do more research. But is it true that Hinduism do believe in such a notion of that, you know, you are born in your caste and you leave your caste and you better...
Well, the thing with Hinduism is that there is no book like, for example, the Bible, which would encompass everything that people believe. So you can't say that all Hindus believe in that. There might be some Hindus who believe in that, but on the other hand, there are many Hindus who would be very cosmopolitan in their beliefs and not embrace these ideas. So, you know, it really depends on which Hindus you're talking about.
I see. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Other calls are welcome this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with Manuel Suri. He's the author of The Death of Vishnu. My name is Celeste Quinn. Thinking about class and the characters in The Death of Vishnu, between the Asranis and the Pathaks, I believe it's Mrs. Pathak who is looking to climb further within her class, and that is one of the points for her of her what's called a kiddie party, which is a card party.
Right, and many people have asked me what exactly a kiddie party is, And the way it works is that a group of people, usually women, will pay something like 100 rupees every week, and this will be put in a pot or a kitty, and one person's name will be pulled out of a hat, and that person will get all that money for that week.
Hmm. And Mrs. Patak goes to quite the extremes to impress the women at the kitty party that she hosts, that actually is run by someone else, but takes place in her apartment.
Yeah, there's a definite pecking order that's in this kitty party, and Mrs. Patak is trying desperately to rise in that limited scale that she's involved in.
Yeah. Also in this novel, there are quite a few names of films, of movies. And reflecting on our caller's comments this afternoon, how is Indian life reflected in the movies in terms of class and in terms of relationships between Hindu and Muslim?
Well, someone once said that there are only three plots in Hindi movies. And by Hindi movies, I'm talking about what are called masala Hindi movies. Masala is the spice mixture that you find in Indian food, and this reflects the combination of romance and dances and fights and comedy and tragedy that you will find in the more commercial Hindi movies. And one of the plot lines, which actually occurs in this very book, is that there's a Hindu girl or a Muslim girl who falls in love with someone from a different religion. So in this case, Kavita Asrani, the daughter of the Asranis, falls in love with a Muslim, Salim Jalal. And this is a very melodramatic, romantic-type film plot. It's not necessarily so indicative of reality, but I've seen many films like that. And Kavita, who thinks of herself as the heroine of a movie, just goes along with it.
Mm-hmm. And her imagination is fueled by the movies, her idea of love and romance.
Yes, very much so. In fact, I would guess that many people in India, maybe even myself, when we think of romance, you know, we think of film actors on screen. And unfortunately, romance in Hindi films often is expressed through these wild, extravagant dances and songs. And until recently, you couldn't really show people kiss on the screen. So it was disallowed. If there was a hero who wanted to kiss a heroine, they would duck behind a tree and then come out wiping their lips to show that they've just kissed.
Yeah. As opposed to Kavita, Vishnu has a very different... His remembrances of love and romance are quite different. He, as he is lying there, he's dying, he remembers Padmini, a prostitute, and how he longed for her. How does he see her?
Well, he sees her as someone who represents life and lusciousness and lushness and sexuality, and someone who's not quite attainable. He's always trying to impress her by her presence. Once he steals a car to give her a joyride, and he's always trying to get closer to her. He knows that she's not attainable, but she remains someone that he's always loved. And in one of the final scenes where he sees his life flash before his eyes, as a movie, in a film theater, Padmini is by his side, and he's finally going to the movies with her.
Mm. Interesting. At one point, he also takes her to the movies.
Right. He takes her to a fair. There, when I was young, I used to go to these little fairs that used to be held at festivals, and they would have these purloined little reels of movies, you know, little snippets from movies, and they would show them for half a rupee or something, and he would sit in this canvas tent. And when he takes Padmini to one of these makeshift theaters, she's somewhat outraged that he hasn't brought her to a proper theater.
Hmm. While movies play a role in his vision of romance and love, he doesn't see himself in the role of the suitor that rides in on the charging horse or that people are going to be singing about. I mean, when he imagines a life with this woman, it's very simple and ordinary.
Yeah, that's what he craves. In one scene, he's just thinking how nice it would be to just have an address and just a bathroom that he could call his own and just be with this woman and have a very simple life. Again, it depends on where you are on the steps. Since he has pretty much nothing, this is already something pretty high to aspire to.
Hmm. Let's go back in time to Vishnu's childhood, because this also gives us some insight into who this man is. Tell us about how Vishnu's mother sees her son and what she tells him about himself.
Well, Vishnu's mother is shown in one scene in particular where she's playing with Vishnu, and just like mothers do, and since he's named after this god, she's telling him about the various incarnations of the god Vishnu, and playing with him and saying, well, you're named after this god, you are this god. I have a cousin whose son is named Ram, and she does the same thing. She says, you are Ram, and your wife is Sita, and so on and so forth. So his mother tells him all these tales. She tells him tales of reincarnation and tales of fantastic birds that fly in the forest and meet mythological figures like Arjun. And she fills him with wonder about these things.
Mm-hmm. She tells him he is an avatar, a deity descended to earth.
Right.
And she also tells him stories about Jeev, who is this character that, or this, I don't know, how would you describe
it's
Jeev?
It's a spirit.
A spirit.
One of the things that Hinduism propounds is that the only thing that's permanent is your spirit that goes from life to life. That's the only continuity that we experience. So Jeev is a spirit that starts maybe as an insect and then grows to more complex life forms and finally becomes human.
Mm-hmm. Offering a lot of hope for someone like Vishnu.
Yes, that even if this lifetime isn't good, perhaps in future lifetimes you will reach a higher level.
Yeah. And back to Mr. Jalal, this also has an impact on him, and the two characters come together at a point in the story. And I hate to give too much away in these kinds of interviews about novels, but
right.
But they have an experience together, and they come away changed people.
Yeah, this actually is almost symbolic of my reading the Bhagavad Gita. When I read that, I was quite profoundly moved by it. And there is a scene in the Gita which is where Krishna reveals himself. He's supposed to be a charioteer, but then he reveals himself as someone supernatural to Arjun. And this scene is so famous that Robert Oppenheimer quoted it when he saw the first atomic blast. And I thought that was the perfect vehicle to let Mr. Asrani experience what he has been searching for, experience something that is truly outside the realm of what he can explain by the limited resources of logic that he has.
Mm.
Of course, it might just be a dream.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the crucial contradictions that Mr. Jalal has to negotiate. Where does reality end and faith start?
Mm.
And that's where he's caught.
Mm. What was the toughest challenge you faced writing The Death of Vishnu?
Well, there was one point where I was stuck. It was after the second chapter. And I had this scene where the ambulance had to come. and take Vishnu. But except that if it took Vishnu away, that the story would end there. So I had to figure out why would the ambulance come there but not take Vishnu. And this took me about a year and a half to figure out. And now, of course, I can't believe that. And anyone who reads the book will find that hard to believe.
Yeah.
It seems so simple, you won't even notice it. But that just goes to show you what, it just takes time to work through some things.
Yeah.
And for me, that turned out to be the biggest challenge.
The answer was right there in that building.
Right, exactly.
We won't say anything more.
Yeah.
When did you begin writing?
I began around 83 or 84. This was very soon after I became, after I joined the faculty at the university. And I remember one thing in particular. There was a professor who gave a talk in our department, and he's a well-known mathematician, also a well-known bridge player. And someone dismissed his talk. They said that anyone who plays bridge can't possibly do good mathematics. In other words, if you have a second interest, then that's a negative mark against you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost like a rebellion against that, that I said, well, I have to do something else. Of course, I kept it a secret because I did want tenure. and it was only recently that I really revealed myself.
I wonder what kind of stories we could come up with if we put professions within different apartment buildings.
That's right, yeah.
Really interesting.
I was interested because I was amazed that after I came out with my own extracurricular activities, other people came to me and started saying, well, I act and so on. I mean, they had other interests too.
Hmm. But it started out as a rebellion, but you must enjoy it very deeply to have kept at it and now have this book to your credit.
I don't know if I'd call it enjoyment. I think it's always enjoyable to have written, but while you're writing, it's always it often is frustrating. So there's something that forces you to keep doing it.
Will you keep doing it?
Yes, I hope so.
Yeah. Outside of being stuck there for a while at the end of the second chapter, did the novel change much over time as you were writing it?
Not that much. The only big change I made, and even that wasn't so big, was for a while I had, there's a brief mention of Akbar, who's a Mughal emperor, who started this religion called Deen Ilahi, which combined principles of Hinduism and Muslim, the Islam faith. And that I had a whole scene with him, which I, whittled down a little.
Hmm. Had you anything published prior to this novel?
The only thing that I did have was, I hate to say it, but in Bulgarian. It was a short story that was published in a Bulgarian journal.
Now, how does an Indian American come to have something published in a Bulgarian journal?
I kept asking myself that question for many years. And it was very embarrassing because I would apply to writing colonies and, they ask you to send a resume with all your publications. And I would have this miserable little thing where I would write in tiny letters, oh, by the way, this is in Bulgarian. And what happened was I was at a reading, and I read out my work, and and there was someone in the audience who was an editor for this Bulgarian journal. And he asked me to submit it, and I did. And that's how I got this publication.
Hmm. And then from that publication to the death of Vishnu, looking for a publisher, how did that happen?
Well, when I went to...
Why don't you take a sip of water and relieve yourself? And while you do that, I'll reintroduce us, okay? Manuel Suri is our guest this afternoon. He is a writer. He's also a mathematician. We're talking with him this afternoon about his novel, The Death of Vishnu. It is his first novel. It is published by W.W. Norton. Manuel Suri earned his Ph.D. in mathematics from Carnegie Mellon University. He teaches at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we have a few more minutes remaining in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join the conversation, you're more than welcome. Questions and comments are encouraged. The telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. So looking for a publisher, was it difficult?
Well, actually, I just had such great luck. I was at a writing colony called the McDowell Colony, and someone suggested I get in touch with an agent that this person knew. He was a fellow writer there. And that's what I did, and that agent liked my work, and she's the one who then submitted it to various publishers. And when she did that, she told me this might take months. Well, it took about a week, and it was just incredible. I was in India at the time, and she sent me an email and said there's going to be an auction. And for the next week or so, every evening, my family and I would sit around the telephone and just wait for the calls to come in. There would be editors from New York. There would be my agent. And we would keep listening to what new things had happened that day. And it was just amazing. It was like the telephone was a television set or something, our source of entertainment.
Wow. It's really such a lovely book, and as soon as I opened it, I mean, we didn't ask to receive it, but it came in the mail, and I opened the book, and I thought, oh, this is good. And that was before I heard any of the buzz on the novel, so my hat's off to you. And thank you for writing it, because it's such a delight to read.
Well, thank you.
Let's talk with another listener here before we run out of time. And this caller is on the campus of the U of I on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I notice this combination of someone who is a mathematician or some other profession writing books or performing instruments and other kinds of arts seem to be much more common in the Indian society than elsewhere. I may be wrong, but it's a thought that maybe your guest can express his views on, if that is a true impression, and why that seems to be more common in the Indian society than elsewhere, where people pursue their profession and they are writers by profession or musicians by profession, and that's it. Whereas people like Mr. Suri, who is a mathematician, and there are several people like doctors and others who have made names as actors and in the movies. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, that's an interesting point. I'm not quite sure what the statistics are, but certainly other people come to mind, like Akhil Sharma, who's an investment banker and who's also written a book, Abram Burgess, who's, I think, also of Indian origin. He's a doctor and also a writer. I'm not sure what's going on. If there is something that in our background that makes us want to do these things, it sounds pretty crazy on the surface to be doing two things. But on the other hand, there's no reason why people can't do it. It's nice to have something to fall back on, some sort of secret life almost that I led, which distances you from mm-hmm. your main profession and gives you another outlet.
Mm-hmm. On the heels of this listener's comments and question, when it comes to making a connection between math and the arts, music comes immediately to mind, but not so quickly mathematics and literature. In fact, I don't even know that I would put the two together.
Right. Unfortunately, my father has all the musical talent in my family, and you know, both my mother and I are complete zeros in that department. So music was definitely out. So maybe that's why, out of desperation, I had to resort to literature. I should point out that there is another mathematician who has written a novel. His name is Guillermo Martinez, and he's actually from Argentina, and his novel regarding Rodera has been translated into English, and it's quite amazing.
Mm. I asked earlier the obvious question, you know, when did you begin to write and why? Now I'd like to know, when did you become interested in math and why?
I think I was interested from pretty young on, and I think there's something within all of us, perhaps, or at least a large percentage of us, where we like to do calculations. Now, that might not be something dominant in people's brains. It might be something that gets sour by a bad experience. But there is something which, you know, if you have two numbers, one on top of the other, you like to find the common factors and cancel them out. At least I felt that inside me. And so I was always interested in math. And in India especially, if you're good in studies, you're usually pushed towards the sciences and towards math. So it was quite natural for me to at least go into the sciences. And then from that, I actually was a physics major, but then there was this professor who taught abstract algebra, and I was his pet pupil, and he kept trying to get me to switch to math, which I finally did. And I'm glad I did. It's a fascinating subject.
Mm. Within the field, what is your specialty? What is your interest?
My field is called numerical analysis. It's a branch of applied mathematics rather than pure mathematics. I work a lot with engineers like structural mechanics engineers who might be designing components of a car or components of machinery. They have to find out what the stresses are which these components will have to withstand, and they have to make sure that these components are strong enough. So they end up with these very complicated equations which you need a computer to just approximate. And my branch of mathematics looks at these methods of approximation and analyzes them to see if they will work or not, and then gives some sort of confidence to engineers saying that, you know, the error that you get in this approximation won't be too large.
Mm. Today, did this area that you work in, did it help you create the character Pran, one of Kavita's suitors?
The young engineer. Well, I there's this rivalry between engineers and mathematicians. so this was a good opportunity to paint Pran as a, you know, as someone who's not particularly attractive, who's pimply faced and blushing and
so
not
shy.
Articulate, and a stamp collector. Perhaps the most damning of all.
And those mathematicians, they're more like the handsome Muslim boy, Salim.
Yeah, and we are, you know, we are writers and whatever.
It has truly been a pleasure talking with you this afternoon. Thank you so much. I'm sorry we're out of time. I wish the best to you, and I look forward to your next work.
Well, thank you very much.
Manil Suri has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Death of Vishnu, a novel. It is his first novel. It is published by W.W. Norton.